You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Natalie Nichols. I'm the director of RSA Global here at the RSA. And I'm here to welcome you to our special lunchtime event. It's a delight to see everybody. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you today's guest speakers. We have John Brown, who is the CEO of BP from 1995 to 2007. Through a period of transformation and expansion which saw BP grow into one of the world's largest companies. Lord Brown is a Fellow of the Royal Society, a past President of the Royal Academy of Engineering, the Chairman of Trustees of the Tate Galleries and the Donmar Warehouse. Warehouse, not Warhouse. Sorry about that. He was knighted in 1998 and made a life peer in 2001. He's now an investor in the energy sector, and the author of memoir Beyond Business and the popular science book, Seven Elements That Changed the World. He joins us today to talk about his book, The Glass Closet, which has just been released in paperback, and which tells the story of his own journey towards coming out as a gay man after spending his entire career in the closet. The book is accompanied by an online campaign and resource website helping to raise awareness of the continuing challenges facing LGBT employees in the corporate world. Why is it that despite the fact that gay men and women in the Western world now enjoy greater acceptance and more legal protection than ever before, only one of the Fortune 500 and one FTSE 100 CEO is openly gay? Following the recent election, the UK is now the largest number of LGBT MPs in the world. Is there something that the business community can learn from the recent remarkable transformation of our political landscape? Or is there indeed much more work to be done? These are the questions that Lord Brown will be addressing us today. And after his opening remarks, we're delighted that we'll be joining in conversation by Ivan Masso. A former chairman of the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, Ivan has long been active in UK politics and has recently joined the 2016 London mayoral election race as the Conservative candidate. So let's get started. Please join me in welcoming Lord John Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I thought I'd talk a little bit about my book, which was published a year ago and came out again last week in paperback and covers some of the things, too, that I've learnt over the last year since the first publication of the book. I'd like to talk about four things, then. Why I wrote this book, what I think is so important about having role models in business, why I wrote the book to the straight majority as well as to the gay minority, and what's it really do to business if you can have a really inclusive workforce, one where everybody feels safe to be themselves rather than pretending to be somebody else, and what does that actually do for you? When I was promoting this book, I mean, publishers obviously want you to make sure they minimize their losses, Or possibly increase their profits. And so you are sent around the world to talk about the book. Actually, I found it a fascinating set of experiences, and I learned a lot. I was in Henley-on-Thames at the literary festival there. Without wishing to offend anyone, I would say that Henley-on-Thames is a rather conservative place, with a small C, that is, and probably with a big C too. But it was not known for the things which are new and modern necessarily. After I had finished talking, I was in the theatre there. I was signing books on the stage, and a couple came up and asked if I would sign a book. And they were a middle-aged couple, very pleasant people, and I always ask, and who should I make the book out to? Who should I sign it to? And they said, well, we'd like you to make it out to our son because we'd like him to come out. And I thought this said something really very important to me about not characterizing generations in any particularly fixed way. Something very different is happening. Now, when I was a child, things were very different, of course. I'm quite old. I was born in 48, and when I was at university, it was still illegal to make any homosexual act. The Wolfenden Report, a decade in its thinking after it had been published, eventually was passed into law in 67. I was also the son, I was the son of a late mother who was an extraordinary survivor. She'd survived Auschwitz, and her two rules of life were, first, make sure if you're going to survive, never tell anyone a secret, because a secret shared is no longer a secret, and they'll use it against you. And secondly, remember that when the going gets tough, all minorities are hurt by the majority. And that is a rule of life. And that's exactly what she discovered, of course, in her experience. So, society being the way it was, my mother driving these lessons home, several others, into my head, it was pretty clear to me that by the time I was leaving Cambridge, it was not a good idea to expose my sexuality. And so I lived a double life. I lived, it was rather exciting. It was, felt, made you feel like a double agent, you know, sort of, you had you had the legend and you had the reality and you never let them come together. And I got very practiced at that, and I knew how to adjust stories in a way which never let on, apparently never let on, about who I was. And I did that for many years. And when I joined the board of BP, for example, in the early 90s, I remember being listening to a conversation about the selection of a very senior member of the company, where the people selecting said, well, of course, he could be a bit of a risk because he's just got divorced. And I thought to myself, I wonder what they would have said had a bit of a risk. He's queer, you know. And so that was the environment. And I carried on until I became very well known. I realized I couldn't go out as a secret because everybody knew who I was. So I made a whole series of really dreadful, dreadful judgments, because I decided the safest way to do this was to go onto a website, a primitive website, and get an escort. So I thought that was safer. And then I decided that I could build a relationship with him. That was really a bad judgment. And then when he sold his story to the Sunday newspapers, I took out an injunction against it all. And those were the days of super injunctions. No longer with us, I think. Good. Thank goodness. In so doing, I perpetuated a myth, a story, which was a lie, in the witness statement, which I corrected thereafter. But the die was cast at that point, and I was outed in May 2007. One of the reasons I wrote this book is I wanted to make sure nobody thought what I'd done was a good idea. It wasn't a good idea. And when you're not yourself, in one way or another, something bad happens. Something really bad happens. And I wanted that lesson out there. The second thing I observed was people, very well-meaning people, talking about being yourself, coming out, being yourself in business. There are plenty of stories which are heart-rending about how people weren't and how eventually they came out and could be themselves. In my book, I talk about a woman engineer in the United States who eventually summoned up the courage to come out. And she said it's a bit, she got all her colleagues into her office and said, you know, I want you to imagine what it's like to be in the closet by taking off your wedding ring, taking down all the photographs of your family, changing he to she to he in the description of the weekend, and not being able to visit, which is still the case then, your partner, your lover, your wife, your husband, in the hospital when they're ill. So it was all these stories, and I said to myself, the key thing that I remember, I still believe very firmly in business, is that you need to have role models. When you talk to people about what they might want to do or what they should do, the very best way of getting people to believe you is to show them why, how other people have done it. Real people, not just theoretical people, and getting people to identify a bit with them in order to be comfortable that what you're saying is right. And I've realized that in business, there weren't that many out role models in big business, in corporate US, corporate America. And when I looked at, as I think we said in the introduction, when I looked at the S&P 500, the FTSE 100, when I started writing this book, there were actually no out gay CEOs. And I said, this is statistically improbable. Something's not right here. Either people have deselected themselves, or they've been unable to take the risk of being themselves, or maybe they've been discriminated against. But one of the above. And the lack of role models leads people to have an understanding, a theoretical understanding of what to do to make it safe for people to come out in business, but no real examples. And now we have two, which is good. But what I talk about in my book, and I talk to CEOs the whole time about it, is please make sure you laud and applaud role models, because they're the people who will make a difference to you when getting people to feel safe to come out in business. And I think that's a really very important point that again and again I can see. What I've observed is speaking to people around the world, I get lots of stories of people who say, no, I'm not prepared to come out because I think it's unsafe. Something will happen to my career. In a very competitive environment, the choice between two people, a more conventional, unconventional, from the selector's point of view, it may be damaging to my future. So I'm not prepared to come out. Equally, there are plenty of others who also come out. But you can see again and again, for example, plenty of students are out at university, and when they go into business, they go straight back into the closet because they're not quite sure whether it's safe to be themselves. The third reason I wrote this book was to try and engage the leaders, the CEOs, the top people in companies, to do more than just say it's a good thing, to allow LGBT people to come through their organization, but to be much more proactive, to make it part of the company's real determination, but more than just to say it, but also to provide ways of measuring what's going on and to spend time with managers who are very hard put upon nowadays with plenty of things to do, to give them space in their agenda, so that they can spend time thinking about the people who work for them in difference, not just all the same. And that takes time. And I know because I still run large organizations, people say, well, it's all very well, John, you've told us there are 99 things and here's the number 100. Please tell us which we should do first. And I think you've got to say to people, this is really important to the business. And that's my fourth point, and then I'll stop. I do think it's really very important to business to get engagement of teams right. It's always been my experience that it is amazing what you can do when you have a team of people who are engaged in the purpose of a business, which goes beyond just making money. It makes a huge difference in the way people create, the way they think, and the way they're prepared to work together. Egos somehow disappear when teams are really engaged. And the precursor to engagement is inclusion. And I think people test inclusion by looking at the hardest cases. They say, well, it's all very well, we've managed to make some progress on the gender gap. We haven't made great progress. We've made some progress. But if we've made no progress with different race, different sexuality, then people say, I'm not quite sure we're there yet. Are we really going to believe in engagement? In fact, when I was doing the book, we found a couple of women who'd been around one of these recruitment fairs, which we were at, and we they were going and asking several of the very large companies what their LGBT policies were. So we naturally asked them, were they gay? And the answer was absolutely not. They were straight. But they said the single most important thing they thought about working out whether they could get on, whether inclusion really worked, was whether people handled gay people well, because it was so much more of a challenge than what everybody else is doing, which is trying to get women into business. I found that very interesting. And this is where I think it all ties in a corporate sense. So long-term studies, and this is where I'm afraid money and numbers come in, long-term, but this is about business, long-term studies show, and there are lots of long-term studies about engagement. Long-term studies show that engaged teams produce higher returns than unengaged teams. And the more engaged they are, the more returns there are. And so over a 20-year period, you can assume that if you hit the high point of engagement, you should be able to make 2% per annum higher return on equity than those who are moderately engaged. Now, for those in business, a 2% return per annum is, you do an awful lot to get there. You have to cut a lot of costs. You have to create a lot of markets. It's an amazing alpha, as it were. And if you can get that by doing some very simple things to make people feel that they can be themselves in business, then you're on a winner. And so I think that there is no argument against making sure that inclusion is right at the top of the agenda. Come back to saying, when you talk to managers, it seems to me you say, well, of course the important thing is to do is whatever you can in an ethical way with what you've got to make the highest returns. And the number one thing you should start thinking about is engagement, which means inclusion, which means handling your attitude, your stance, and all the things you can do to make it safe for people to be themselves in business. That applies to the Western world. It applies to a lot of the world. It doesn't apply to 77 countries in the world, where, of course, either promoting or taking or acting in a gay way could either send you to prison or send you to give you a death sentence. We have very different problems to solve there, and perhaps we can do that during the conversation period. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all I want to say for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, and it's of course it's an honour to stand next to Lord Brown, who I've met once or twice, but he's always been, well, he said it was the person or the legend, and for me he's always been the legend. And and I wanted to talk about my journey to London, how I got started, and how I got started into politics as well, and why I think the way you live your life is political, and the way you run your business is political. So I came to London about 30 years ago with nothing, I'm proud to say. It's useful now to talk in that way. But in a very kind of Dick Whittington style, you know, I came here without money to make my fortune, not probably believing the streets of London were paved with gold in that kind of that fashion, and of course realizing it's a hard city and it's hard to get on. London for me, luckily for me, London's a meritocracy, and I think if you're prepared to make the effort here, you can get on. And even at that stage, it was a very inclusive city and a very wonderful city. Now, I decided to set up a business that helped people in HIV and high-risk groups in the financial services sector. And it was an incredible time, because until then, anyone who was out at all, which, and now I have a great privilege to know them, but Julian Clary and Boy George or John Inman, or, you know, it was a completely different atmosphere, and no one with, in inverted commas, anything to lose would dare come out, and certainly anyone in business. And I remember that when I set this business up, the word gay was used in every interview that I ever did. Gay financier, Ivan Masso, gay this. And it's taken really until very recently for that tag to be dropped, you know, as if it's also somehow a spectacle. And it was everywhere. It was in all the financial papers. It was just sensationalized. No one in the financial services sector had come out before and just been a normal guy who goes to work in a suit and offers finance. At the time, we had a retail financial services company. And that's when I realized that what I was doing was political. And that's when I realized that what I was doing had the ability to change the world. And in some respects, I'm very proud to be credited, or that business was credited with creating the notion of a pink pound. And of course, I saw that pink pound as being, if I could get more and more companies involved in providing financial services or providing products, services generally for the gay community, then of course, the net result would be that that if shareholders were involved and business was involved, it would just put in my slice of the human rights cake, the bit that I was trying to push forward, the bit I could do, which was from a business perspective, would help to further this cause. We couldn't help lots of the people who came to see us. In fact, we were if you were HIV positive, you basically had a death sentence in the early 90s, and you'd probably convert to AIDS and die within 12 years. And financial services companies knew this, so you couldn't get mortgages, you couldn't get life insurance, because it was all bound up together. The best you could do was offer advice, and we didn't have the heart to charge anyone for advice because they were in such, often sometimes they lost their jobs, they weren't in position to write checks. But what happened was we became one of the largest financial services companies in the country. We were like the third largest financial services company in our sector, with branches all around the UK. And there were people coming to us, regardless of their sexuality or their HIV status, because they liked what we did. They suddenly understood. They were voting for me, effectively. They were, and it was a wonderful, it was a really exciting feeling. I was on Big Breakfast every morning with Paula Yates, and doing Richard and Judy, and it was transformative. And slowly, lots and lots of other groups started to come out. I created an online social network called Jake, which is a social network for gay people gay professionals to come and meet. These days, every single company in the city seems to have an LGBT department and a sort of a whole network, LGBT network. Politics, when I moved to politics, I remember the hardest thing for me was coming out as a conservative, harder than coming out as gay. Because naturally, it was easier to declare, to wear the clothes as of a sort of left, sort of socialist Labour supporter, because, it still is, you know, it's still almost, I feel like a tribal instinct of people who are in minority groups generally, but especially the gay community, to identify with the Labour Party. And of course, I want to be a conservative because I believed in, I'm entrepreneurial, I believe in small state and low taxation and buying my own house and all that sort of stuff. I'm right up with the conservative programme. I just couldn't, and I think Margaret Thatcher would be, if she was born today, I think she would be completely up with kind of the kind of values, because it's treating people like adults. And I needed to bring the Conservative Party to the centre. And my way of doing that actually was to be Margaret Thatcher's official escort at the 1999 conference in Blackpool. And of course, hundreds, maybe thousands of my customers cancelled their policies. And so it was, in one day, my best day and worst day. And that those photographs still follow me around, even though that was completely, you know, really pre-internet as we know it. What I was doing there was, as I was doing in business, I was walking tall and proud, but this time in the Conservative Party, and showing that, by example, the Conservative Party must be moving to the centre, because there I was with one of the greatest Conservatives that's ever lived, and someone who would have been accused of being further to the right. Now, today, as I said earlier, we've got LGBT groups everywhere. And also, if you were to be at Cambridge today, you'd probably find it easier to get into your industry or into many industries, like law, legal profession or other financial services, because according to my friends at university, there are all these kind of LGBT awareness days or open days held by Goldman Sachs. And many of my straight friends think it's slightly unfair now. They almost wish they could be gay because they feel it's kind of easier to start to interact with companies and get those interviews and form a bond. And maybe it's even unfair. And the question, I think, and you kind of alluded to it slightly, the question is this just window dressing, or is it just nice that we live in a more equal society? Or actually, is this good for business? Now, I asked myself, what does a gay person, LGBT person, bring to the story if I'm an employer? Well, they're snappy dressers, you can see. But they have incredible social mobility. Now, I don't know if that's because they were chameleons as young people, pretending to be lots of people, having to work out how other people behave and sort of mimic them. Or I don't know if it's also because I could very easily be Lord Brown's friend by accident, by virtue of our sexuality. And as I've traveled through the gay community, I've come across people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And it seems to bridge those social divides. And I think that could be very useful in business. They're also geographically very mobile. It's easy to send a nice young gayer off to New York or something like that. They're going to have fun. They're less likely, though that trend is changing, to be taking a family and children with them. But there's another thing that came up, and I was really interested in it. I spoke to a young man actually once who was offering me help on my campaign. And he works in the city, works in the stock exchange, and he said that he's out and completely happy, and he was a real lad, you know, just a normal guy. And he said that what he conveys when he talks to people about his sexuality is authenticity. And now he uses it as a device. He said, I almost feel embarrassed using this. He uses it as a device to gain people's trust, where in the old days people might have gone to golf clubs or gone shooting with their... Or taking cocaine in the local wine bar, or done some laddie thing to get closer. He was finding that people instantly just trusted him, they respected him, and across the board, no matter who he was talking to, it was an instant in. So I'll just leave on one thought, which is why, of course, it's important for business, and of course it's important for the individual, but why is this important for London? And of course, that's very pressing or very important to me. Well, I see London as a flag bearer for human rights, and it speaks to the issue that you talked about in these 70-odd countries where being gay is not tolerated or could even see being executed. It's not just LGBT issues. It can't be much fun living in Beijing and seeing the rest of the world using the internet freely, or being in Dubai and not being able to drive a car or travel without your husband's permission. So London is a flag bearer for human rights. And of course, I had this sort of dream that sane, uncomplicated, modern minds running the city will inadvertently, because of the way they live their lives and the way they run their businesses, be flag bearers for how a great city should be. And when I travel to these other cities, so I love going to these wonderful places. I love my visit to Beijing and meeting the Foreign Office. Well, I know that one day, their city will look like London. London's not going to look like them. We're not going to go in that direction. There's no way. There are any Putin-esque restrictions going to be placed on our people. And that is politics. Thanks very much, anyway.
Thank you both very much. I'm going to ask one question, and then I will open it out to the audience in the interest of time. I mean, listening to both of you, there is obviously a dichotomy between the increased awareness of LGBT and minority groups now, but the lack of visibility when it comes to leadership. You know, we've had Caitlyn Jenner come on the cover of Vogue, and Ireland has just said yes to gay marriage. But this obviously isn't translated into the corporate world. This week, John, you've launched a campaign of Be Out at Work and sent a letter to 150 politicians and business leaders. So I suppose I'm interested, from both your perspectives, where are these trends going to lead to? And how is that going to actually create some real change in business?
Well, because I'm a businessman, I'm an optimist anyway. You have to be in business. But I hope I'm also realistic. But first I'd say that if I were scoring this, I'd say the glass is definitely more than half full. There is no doubt about that. And no one should ever think that we're back in the 50s to 90s. We're not. We're in a very different place. So that's, I think, very important. Secondly, I think people are doing a lot of well-meaning activity to change the way in which leadership thinks. So Ivan mentioned these LGBT networks. I think in the professional services firms, as opposed to industry, I think there are a lot of them. But I've spoken to quite a few of them, so and I used to be on the board of one of these financial institutions. And I think people say this, look, unless the leader really wants this to work, the LGBT network eventually becomes junior and dominated by the back office and nobody from the front office is there. And that's worse than nothing, in my view, because that sort of says, well, it's delegated to the wrong place. So I'd say that's the second point, is be careful what you do, because if it goes wrong, it's worse than nothing. So be careful. And the third, I think, is what's really important is leaders need to say, I want it to happen, and I'm going to measure what's happening. That's, I think, important. And that's the purpose of my Pride Week campaign. I decided I had to have a Pride Week campaign because I think it's a very important moment to do something. And so I wrote to 150 CEOs and said, you know, what are you doing? Here's a couple of things you could do, which are mostly about leadership acts.
Thank you. Ivan, what about, I mean, you've run businesses. You're now embarking in a very serious political career. How are these trends going to translate into something that is going to allow us to be an inclusive and dynamic society and not label LGBT as a diversity issue, which allows it to put it into a box?
Well, I think I actually think you were right not to come out when you didn't. Your life you lived was probably exactly the right decision for you at the time, because you worked in the oil industry, and I don't think you could have done any of the deals you did globally at that time and score the relationships, because at the time, the social capital, the way people thought, was very conservative, and it still is in many of the countries that, that your successor is operating in. Today, though, in London especially, social capital, our currency, the way we value, the way we evaluate someone else is, I think, through art and diversity. We expect them, culture is everything, And you know, if you, let's say you meet some, well, I'll give you an example. Sometimes I have to meet these kind of young conservatives. I know it sounds dreadful. And they have slightly missed the message, and they're doing the whole kind of Pall Mall Club thing, and they're slightly too stiff, and they're a throwback to a time gone by, and they are failing really to communicate with ordinary people around the world, or around London especially. And I don't see them, unless they're William Rees-Mogg, who's actually kind of very funny, they actually don't get on very far. The people who get on are people who are able to engage and who are really involved and really, really committed to this kind of new way of thinking. And of course, they're going to grow up.
Yeah.
And they'll be in your job in 20 years' time, and then I think it would be almost the end of the story. Not entirely. I mean, we had women's rights
a long time ago,
and there's still a ceiling there.
I hope so. I think, you know, I really hope we go through a better progress than gender, women. Because after all the struggle, you know, we've made a great leap forward, and I think, what is it that 12% of all management committees of all the big companies in the UK are women, 12%, one in eight people, after 40 years of... So I think we've got to figure out how to do it faster.
Apparently Sweden is the best country to move to if you're a woman. So on that note, I'd like to open it out to the audience.
Thanks a lot. I just wonder if you have a view on football. Obviously, it's a big business, which is important. We're talking about business. But it's also an immense mouthpiece that the population at large actually listens to, and the statistics within football are probably more disgusting than they are in business. And I just wonder if you have a view on how they could be harnessed to help put things right, really.
You've got me wondering if I could have hidden my gender when I joined the oil business in the 80s. Might I have been tempted? So my question is whether all of us are in some kind of closet, not necessarily sexuality one, and do you think that it would be good for business if we all came out of whatever's stopping us being ourselves?
Okay, that might be quite a straightforward answer. Good. Next question, please.
Third question, going back to your final point, actually, on the in a globalizing world, how do we actually engage the rest of the world, those 77 countries, and actually are we in danger of actually going back to a leveling place where actually some things get rolled back in this country or other, so to speak, Western countries, to actually get to a comfortable place in the world, which I find a very almost troubling position, particularly as the world is globalizing very, very fast.
Okay, lovely. Some very insightful questions. So, football being the mouthpiece, but probably, arguably, we don't have any statistics to hand, but a poor representation of LGBT people in football. What could be done to put things right?
Football, I don't know a great deal about football being gay. And the, no, sorry. I'm joking. but the, I had the great, I used to know poor old Justin Fashanu. He was a friend of mine, and it was great. Great, terrible when he committed suicide. And I know now, I'm privileged to know some of the young stars who have come out, like Gareth Thomas and Tom Daley. And only when more of them start coming out, and I think sponsors have a large part to play in just doing it, just coming out and supporting our sports people, because the more they do, the more agents won't be telling them to stay in the closet. And I think it is that kind of relationship with the agents. And sometimes I worry for little Tom, in fact, because although he's really enjoyed coming out, it's been an immense thing for him to do, and he's a role model across the board, you know, I worry that he does a little bit too much LGBT work. And I think the risk, and there's another, I just wish that people would come out and then just continue on and support breast cancer and all the things they want to do, rather than being too involved in this one area.
So, while my book was about business, I thought sport was a very important business. So I interviewed a couple of footballers, because the obvious conclusion was that footballers become gay when they retire. And that is the conclusion. So I went to, so I interviewed a very, very important footballer, Thomas Hitzlsperger, about before he came out, about what the issues were. And he, I think, made the clearest of all. He said, because I said, it's got to be the fans, right? He said, not at all. It's not about the fans. It's about the team. He said, any difference in the team will make you the person to be blamed if they lose. And he said, and that's the way teams work. You've got to do everything together, be the same. It's a different form of inclusion, which I found an interesting observation, and one which also explains why it's easier for sole performers, divers, people like that, swimmers, to come out than it is a member of a football team. And what to do about it, I'm absolutely with you. I think it's the sponsors who need to say, you know, we need to get this right.
And I suppose this leads very nicely into our second question, which is, are we to an extent all in the closet? And would it be good for business and politics if we all just came out?
The answer is absolutely yes. You know, because I do business all over the world, still do, and it's, you know, we occasionally, as I think Ivan said, I mean, London is decidedly in a, what am I call, a golden moment, I think. I hope it's a golden era. And the UK is doing amazingly well, and actually we've become a much more defrosted nation than we used to be. I mean, you know, it's a pretty rigid place in the past. But there are plenty of places still they're so formal, that, you know, you go to a meeting and I've been to meetings and I have to remind myself when I start by saying, ladies and gentlemen, and I look around and say, I mean gentlemen. You know, there's only gentlemen. And then they're all wearing their jacket the whole meeting. You know, and they want to call me Lord Brown the whole time. after, it's a very different way of not allowing any light into the person, only light into the business. And that's a very bad way, I think, of conducting any enterprise, in my view.
And I think this probably, again, leads on to our third question, which was, in an increasingly globalised world, there are 77 countries that don't at all have any of the politics or the inclusiveness of London. And I think if I understood the question right, is how can what we're learning here in London and in some of the more enlightened countries, if you want to call it that, how can that be spread around in terms of global meetings? And given, and I suppose I'm particularly interested as well, given that the organisations or the businesses that you have both been involved in are global and therefore do understand or do have exposure to some of the trends that are happening. Is that translating into some of these more conservative places? And if not, how can they?
So I think progress is slow, but I think there is progress. So I think any corporation that's working on a global stage recognises completely that when they go into a country, they're actually there under licence, they're not there by right, and they have to abide by the laws. So the operations day-to-day have to be absolutely legal, and there can be no messing around with that. But I think a CEO, in discussing with, let's say, a head of state, has an agenda of things where you can encourage people, you can nudge change by saying, well, I could do more economically with you, I could do more investment. Or you might suggest to people that their reputation, both in whether it's in the bond market or in the general state of affairs, might be improved if they lightened up somewhat and started making some changes. It doesn't always work, and you have to be very careful, and some things would clearly be foolish to try on, you know, where you're going straight into the face of a state which is based on religious foundations that have rejected any debate of any sort on sexuality. But there are plenty of places you can begin to do that. I think also that, you know, if you've got a company where you actually know who's gay and people are proud to be out, then you can, if you're moving people around the world, you can move gay people into places which are tough to work in for gay people, as long as everybody knows what the measure is. You know, and it's good to do that because it shows that actually people work on a level playing field, regardless of sexuality. But it's tough, and if you don't know, then you've created a tremendously dangerous situation for everybody. You have to do it with the full knowledge. And even then, it doesn't... I mean, I spoke to IBM, have been doing this for ages, and I think my former company does it. But they're tremendous dangers because... you know, for people who are locally employed you know, they say, OK, well, we can be out inside the walls of the company, and then they leave the office and they get beaten up, you know, yeah. And that's not what you want.
No, not at all. I mean, this is a particularly interesting topic in terms of a vision of London, yeah. And what London represents for other cultures that come and visit the city.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the answer is to keep London successful and keep it economically vibrant. I think if we're strong and the strongest, most important, most glamorous, electric, beautiful, phenomenal city in the world, then as I said in my little talk, we become a torchbearer for best practice. And it's not just, you know, at the moment, a lot of people are worried about housing. And the answer, of course, is to stop foreigners from buying houses here. Now, these foreigners run we have two-thirds of all Fortune 500 companies are based in the UK. We do a third of all global transactions through our stock exchange. We are massive, and people come here and they live here and they buy their homes and they take with them their values back to their countries. And they realise why. They don't just come here because it's a great place to do business or they'll be in Frankfurt. They do here because what we have here is incredibly special. And we need to keep it special, we need to keep it strong, and we keep on talking about our values. And I think if we started talking more about our values as well, I would even have an anthem for London, get kids to sort of talk, a bit like they do in schools in America, start talking about what it means to be a Londoner and what it means to be from the United Kingdom generally, because it is now about diversity and inclusion. And those messages will spread round the world. I'm absolutely sure of it.
An anthem for London. I like that. Further questions? A question here, over there, and down here, please.
Thank you. You mentioned you were a gay conservative, and I'm wondering what you're doing to change things from a political perspective with regards to your colleagues in the party and also in the House of Lords. I don't know what side you sit on, but I'm interested to know, because we all know of politicians saying one thing and doing another, saying one thing and living another way. What's the responsibility on our politicians to lead by example? How can they help change things and be more honest?
Hello, I'm hugely struck by the question, you mentioned it yourself, Lord Brown, about the difference between the improvements in women in business and the gender issue there. And obviously to be female is not actually to be a member of a minority, but half of London, half of the population. And yet somehow one almost senses that you talk about in 20 years, maybe, and I know you were sort of talking lightly, maybe the story would be over in terms of sexual diversity. It feels a very long way to even begin to imagine that for gender, for women. And I just wondered what thoughts you had about why that seems to be taking so long, I think both for all women in general, and I also wonder as well for gay women. They don't have perhaps the cachet of being a snappy dresser. I wonder what I don't mean to be sort of facetious about that, but I do wonder, your two men there, what would it be like, for gender and the sexual diversity to sort of put those together?
Wonderful, some great questions. And lastly,
actually leading from one of the other questions, which is about diversity, but why I'm interested in diversity of thinking as well as sexuality or gender. And so actually you mentioned Margaret Thatcher, a great example of somebody who's diverse woman, but her thinking was more masculine in many ways, my understanding, than actually many of the men she worked with. And you can get like group thinking organizations due to not necessarily a lack of diversity, male, female, gay, straight, but actually due to the way that they're thinking. And something I'm personally coming out with is I'm straight, white, middle class, middle aged. But actually, I've realized just recently that I'm personally quite different in the way that I think. And I'm actually starting to identify and celebrate that. And actually, that's starting to really work for me. But it's taken me until I'm middle aged to recognize that that's something that I can have power with. So it's how we kind of bring that into, like, especially large corporations that kind of set for, it's the team, as you were saying, and the team's got to think a certain way. So I'm really interested in that. Thank you.
So politically, how are you leading by example? What can be done by politicians?
Put a little word in for the Conservative Party. We have more out MPs, and our LGBT Tory group is larger than all the other groups put together. So on the whole, most people are completely with the programme on the Conservative Party. You get apparently, I'm not supposed to say this, but I can't resist it. Apparently, Norman Tebbit still writes in asking for me to be evicted from the party, which I consider an enormous compliment. But slowly these people, we just laugh. You know, it's just one of those things, and as I said before, their views are really no longer relevant, and both parties are a sort of a broad church with extreme views on both sides, and actually, in a strange way, luckily for us, lots of those people are skipping off to move to join UKIP, in fact. So we're being, as militant tendency was separated out by Blair from the Labour Party. But there's always going to be someone, usually they're gay, aren't they? Those ones that are so anti-gay. There's usually a problem that's deeper, because no sane person can get that upset about gay issues these days.
But is there anything in particular? I think the question was...
I'm not saying normally. Well, we could try him, couldn't we?
I think the question was, what can you do to change perspectives? And so is there anything that you feel that, within your role in the Conservative Party, that you should and you can be actively doing, or is it just by the very virtue of doing a good job?
Yeah, I think it's just by stepping out, and this is about your life being political, the way you walk and step up to the challenges ahead of you and just be a good, in AA terms, to say, well, we call it a living amend, to live your, to stop saying sorry and actually just present each day and live your life in a good, upstanding way. And then everyone will just, everyone will just understand what you're talking about.
So I sit on the crossbench, so I'm not a member of any party. But the House of Lords, as you know, had a very vigorous debate on equality of marriage. And it was a very important one. The single largest vote ever, I think, in the House of Lords. And quite remarkable division in the lobby. I thought it was... I spoke, obviously, in it, and I was active in this activity. And I thought it was quite an eye-opener to see how far behind so many of my colleagues in the House were. The caricatures and, you know, well, some of my best friends are gay, and surely we could have equal but separate activities. People had quite forgotten, I think, those phrases from South Africa. So it was both depressing and rather happy moment that the bill became law. So I tried to use it, and I think my colleagues do as well, with every opportunity to make sure there is a level playing field. I'm particularly keen on trying to, I've been asking questions now, and I want to, I'm not a campaigner, because I also do business and other stuff, but from time to time I can do a campaign. I want to make sure that corporations, they obviously have to report their board of directors, top 10 people, their sex. I would like, on a voluntary basis, I think they should report sexuality too. That's to say, everyone should be asked whether they'd like to volunteer what their sexuality is. And I think boards should be required to report under the Financial Reporting Council requirements in their annual reports once a year what the makeup of their board is in this regard. So I've been asking questions in the House. Seems to me we should get this through. And we've got a lot of support. It's very simple. And it's a great way of getting role models out there, you know.
The second question was about gender equality and I suppose the slow progress that has been made for women. And the question was inviting your thoughts on why that has been and, you know, if we are, I think one of you had said 20 years, in 20 years' time this might, you know, not so much be an issue. If you're a gay woman, that potentially could be much longer. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on why the issue of gender equality has taken so long. And really, we're not like Sweden yet, so why not?
I think it's taken so long because people have not really thought through what it takes to select people on a level playing field. You know, you've got a bunch of men, white men, presiding over a selection committee where there are, you know, half women and half men coming in as candidates. They're all equally good. They're going to pick a man. So the most important thing is to have diverse selection mechanisms. I think it's the most practical thing I can say. And I think it's just got, you've got to sort of bang on the whole time about selection mechanisms. It's not about the outcome. It's about I hate process, but this is about process. This really is about getting the right way of making the proper selections. And I don't think that's done everywhere.
Lots of follow-up questions on quotas, but we really don't have time for that. And then the last question, which I think was really interesting, was about diversity of thinking. And I suppose it, to an extent it links back to those that are selecting or making those decisions, and if that, you know, if they are a homogeneous group, or if they're not, but there is a majority of that homogeneous group, then you do get groupthink. I think actually everything we've been talking about is about diversity of thinking. If we don't want LGBT or indeed gender just to be a box that you tick, how can we bring this diversity of thinking?
If I may, I mean, I think, first of all, there are plenty of contributors. And I do think diversity of background, diversity of race, diversity of sexuality, of sex, I mean, all of that contributes. But I also think it's about leadership and about what is required in the way of thinking. And, you know, people will say, well, how can he possibly say this? But I think the biggest danger for any organization is to become part of the establishment. Because at that point, it sets a series of norms which are very difficult to get out of. And I think that's really important. You know, I look at arts organisations, which I chair, and I admire the way that the leaders break, in the nicest possible way, their links to the establishment and established thinking by converting the question and what standards and norms are allauded almost every day. And I think that's really important to think. So the shorthand is, don't become a member of the establishment.
Just a couple of things. Thank you for your question as well. I'd actually realised that my characterisation of gay people was a bit masculine, but I was just trying to be amusing. But that doesn't mean that women, the lesbians I'm meeting, aren't snappy dressers as well. quite the opposite. There's a whole new lipstick kind of revolution going on that's incredibly exciting, and I see lesbians in industry and especially in the city constantly now, and doing incredibly well. But I think the reason why it lent towards to a gay men's right isn't actually because they're blokes, it's because of the whole AIDS thing. And at that time, we were all in the closet, and AIDS really kind of polarised us and forced especially gay men out, because there were such dreadful things being said and we had to stand up and fight. It became a war and we had to stand up and be counted. And although lesbians did stand with us shoulder to shoulder, there was less of an imperative. It didn't quite affect them in the same way. So the numbers in pressure groups I sat on, many of those committees like Outrage and Stonewall, were largely gay men because it was their partners who were dying. And so that's how they got involved. And on the, just on the collective thinking thing, one thing that's come back, and I wish I had the numbers, you probably do, but from what I can tell, companies who have more women on the board outperform companies that don't. And that, I'm sure, is because they, and what's said is because they bring a new kind of thinking to the boardroom that's just rounder and is more savvy. It's more, it connects better with their consumer and their clients and their employees. And that is being seen as valuable. And again, I don't see boards advertising for trying to fill their women vacancies. And actually, they are trying. I got friends of mine who are on the list to be women board members, and they get so many approaches they can't do all the jobs because there are, unfortunately, so few women who are prepared to take those roles. But there does seem to be a clamour. And the reason isn't just to fill up their diversity, it's because they bring something else that's very special for business.
There certainly is an event, a follow-up event about gender equality on the cards there, isn't there? We have run out of time. I'd like to thank both our speakers for joining us today. Thank you so much for your questions. Thank you for joining us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.